Welcome to the Monday Minute of the Hunt Back Country podcast. These are shorter and more informal episodes where we answer your listener questions. I have some great questions today, so thanks as always for sending those in. Steve, how are you doing this morning?
I'm good, man. Really good. Had a good, fun weekend with the family, and we were all out. My wife's got three pretty big garden boxes in the backyard, and they needed sanded and stained, so that was kind of fun process. We were doing that yesterday. Just got the kids out there, and Joey's just making a freaking mess everywhere, and it was pretty comical. I was just literally
Yeah.
behind him with the paint, like with the paintbrush, fixing all the big old drops and stuff he was doing. But it was kind of a fun, cool moment. Kids are old enough to be actively like really helping with stuff like that. It's a good weekend. You?
Yeah, it was good. Kind of the same, just a lot of spring, right? Getting stuff done around the house. And then me and my son did a bunch of mountain biking yesterday and had a lot of fun. So it was a good weekend. Last week, we're in recovery slash catching up mode work-wise from being out for the death hike, and much more to come on the death hike this week. We'll have a full podcast recap coming out on Wednesday. Actually, two episodes. One is you and I did our own kind of like recap and story, Steve. And then we also last week were busy interviewing different participants of the death hike. So we'll have a second episode releasing with four different participants, kind of getting their perspective, their lessons learned. We're going to have an article kind of with some stuff to go with that. So stay tuned. That is coming Wednesday on the podcast. But also, in addition to the podcast, if you want to see some photos, gear, kind of some behind the scenes video stuff, that's all going to be through the EXO site. Best way to make sure you don't miss stuff like that is just make sure you receive our emails. You can always sign up for that by going to exomountaingear.com/newsletter, or we will have a link to sign up in the show description for this podcast episode. But today, before we get the death hike later this week, we wanted to, as I said, answer listener questions. This one came in is obviously very timely. Is oh shoot, I didn't even realize, Steve, today's opening day of Bear in Idaho, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yeah.
Not
Right.
planned.
I'll peace out, man. I'll see you later.
Yeah. I didn't realize today was actually going to be opening day. But this question came through about bear hunting. This guy said, "I love the podcast. My question is, what advice do you guys have for field dressing bears? I heard previously that you both shot bears on the same day. Did you use the same method to take care of both bears?" So, good question. I think, I start with this question, Steve, of obviously what are you planning to do, wanting to do with the hide, of course, on those bears. What he mentioned, which was a couple of years ago when we doubled up, we both were super fortunate. Steve shot gorgeous bears in terms of size, but also in color, and we skinned them for bear rugs. So that was, that changes things, of course, when you want to do a rug. But, to start with, I think the biggest thing that, compared to like big game, deer, elk, so many of us as hunters who are hunting in the backcountry are used to doing, a gutless method. And we're typically starting breaking down an animal, deer, elk, et cetera, by working on the back and working in the spine. And with bears, it's going to be the opposite. You're going to get them on their back and obviously start working up the belly, to work on the bear. And then obviously there's some unique things working around the paws, breaking those joints. I'll leave a link to a video that I think is a very helpful description, because obviously this is hard to get into in too much detail, audio only via the podcast. So I will leave a link to a good overview video. But Steve, I guess to elaborate just a little bit, like any tips, takeaways, little things you do be aware of, just to get into that.
No, yeah. I mean, if you're doing a rug, then you want to obviously, you can't split down the spine. So you're going to lay them on their back. And then I'm not an expert here, but I remember talking to a taxidermist years and years ago, before I ever killed my first bear. Like, hey, if I kill one, I want to make a rug out of it. What do I do? And you basically just kind of like make a Y. I mean, you just take the, you want to go, split. You want to find kind of a seam of hair on the inside of the legs to follow. And it's kind of right on the, I don't know, kind of the inside side of the arm, I guess you would say. And just split. You can go, I really just start, yeah, probably at the back paw, go right down, hook, put the knife right at the center of the paw, and then just go right down the arm towards kind of the crotch, I guess. And do the same on the other leg, and then split. And you want to make sure to it'd be it's real easy, you know, you're on a hillside and things are twists or whatever. Make sure that the bear is not like not twisted,
Yeah, that's
so
a
that
great
it's
tip.
really truly laying on its back. So you're not like, oh, I think I'm cutting up the middle, but then you go to reposition the bear and realize that you're like 6 inches off center. So just take a little bit of extra time to make sure everything's like nice and square. And but yeah, split up the belly to the kind of center of the chest, and then from there, imagine just like a Y. You just got one slice is going to go all the way up to the other paw. The other slice is going to go up to the other paw. And then yeah, you just start peeling off the hide from there. As far as like taking care of the paws, again, I don't even mess with that. I just skin all the way up right into like the kind of joint of the wrist. And then just you're going to leave that attached, but then just start skinning around it. It takes a little bit of finesse and time right there to not cut the hide, but also get that off. And then usually you can just break the joints. That's like a misconception I had certainly early on in my hunting, is you always needed a bone saw with you. And I haven't used a bone saw in forever. Basically, you can break down any animal, the entire animal, without a bone saw. It's pretty easy to do, just finding joints, and you get your knife in there and wiggle some things around, and all of a sudden, pop, it comes apart. Yeah, so then you just peel off the hide off the entire body, and then just kind of you start tubing the neck up as far as you can to the ears, and then I go right at the base of the skull, you go down, find the spine, break the head from the spine, which sometimes that goes really smooth. Sometimes it's you seem to fart around with it for an extra 10, 15 minutes, but eventually it comes off. And then that's all I do. I just and then take find a flat spot if you can, lay the hide back out, and then fold the legs into the center, and then just roll it all the way up till you get to the head. Try to roll it up nice and tight, and then you can strap that right to the top of the pack underneath the lid, or put it in the pack if you want. Lots of options from there, but that yeah, seems to work pretty well for me.
Yeah, trying to keep everything symmetrical is really important. So I'm glad you said that about laying that bear out, making sure it's not twisted, it's laying as flat as possible, because that is key to an outcome. You know, if you're looking to save the hide, whether for a rug or just a soft tent, so that's good stuff. And then, yeah, to echo your point on joints, I think that's one of the most, I don't want to say like most important, it's one of the most beneficial things you can learn. And this doesn't just apply to bears, any big game. Is yeah, eliminating that need for a bone saw and just realizing how much you can do with just a standard knife in terms of whether it's hocks on the leg or getting, you know, separation between skull and spine, even breaking down giant bull elk. You just don't need a bone saw, but it does take some work to understand where to break those joints and then how to best break them. And as you said, Steve, sometimes that goes super easy, sometimes it does take a little work for sure, but it's definitely something that's nice when you can use a standard blade and break down a giant bull elk, including some of the bones and joints, and not have to pack a saw around in the backcountry. All right. This next question came through. Guy wrote in, said, I love the podcast and I think a lot about your opinions, which is why I'm writing in. I've recently started using a SIG BDX combo on my rifle. And I am blown away by the ease of use and the accuracy. What are your opinions on these optics, whether it be the BDX system, the Veracity, or whatever else is on the market with similar electronics? Are these products ethical to hunt with, in your opinion? Thank you for all the hours of entertainment you've given me and the work you guys put into doing the podcast. I'm not familiar with what the Veracity is, so I think I would
I'm
have
not
to
either.
look that one up. But yes, so SIGBDX for people who are unaware and what I think he's referring to, because he said the SIGBDX combo. So the combo would be you have a laser rangefinder, and then you have a rifle scope, and they can communicate to each other. So the SIGBDX rangefinder, you would range a target, say it's 423 yards. Within the scope, there's an electronical reticle, for lack of better terms. And so it would give you a precise aiming point in your rifle scope of where you need to hold to shoot what you just ranged, that 423 yards. So obviously, this depends on working correctly. All of your data's in there, your bullet, your BC, your muzzle velocity. All that stuff is set up correctly. That's how it can make this association. And then the rangefinder is communicating wirelessly to the scope, obviously. And so that's kind of a very brief overview of the BDX combo or the BDX system that he's referring to, which on the surface is super cool. You've used it, Steve. I've used it, Steve. I've hunted with it, but I've shot with it. A couple things to think about. One is it's not legal everywhere. So right off the bat, that's going to eliminate some practical hunting use for some people. And then obviously it is a electronic based dependent system. So you're introducing potential failure points of, the rangefinder not communicating to the scope, batteries dying, electronics failing, etc. And most of those rifle scopes can be used in a non-smart, non-electronic fashion. They still have a standard reticle and turrets in them. So those are all asides, but I think to get to his point of, is it ethical? I mean, this we could talk for an hour about this, and I think some of these topics are worth getting more into, so it would be good to do that in the future. At the end of the day, for me, I can't say that the device or the technology is inherently ethical or unethical, but I think how it is used could lead to unethical behavior. And my biggest kind of concern with systems like this, Steve, are the fact that just because you can range something at 400, 600, 800 yards and get a holdover point in your rifle scope, that is maybe 100% precisely accurate in a perfect system, doesn't mean that you as the shooter are capable of executing that shot or should be taking it in the conditions in which you just arranged it and are maybe considering taking the shot. So I think it enables overconfidence for some folks and could lead them to take shots that they shouldn't take, if that makes sense.
100%. Now it like might is it ethical? 1000%. Anything that's going to increase your accuracy and have you make more lethal shots is certainly ethical, if not preferred. The flip side is human nature. Like you just kind of go, oh well, 500 yards is easy now. Let me can I do 700? Can I do 800? Can I do 900? And that's where you directly went to Marcus. Yeah, like if it becomes easy to make these quote unquote shorter range shots, then it's very natural. And I mean, you just have to put your own governor on yourself of like, nope, that's too far, right? And through my, I don't shoot 1/1000th as many rounds as some guys out there do shoot year round, but just through my experience, 600 yards seems to be kind of that things just like kind of start falling apart for me where I stop hitting exactly where I'm expecting to hit every single time, right? So for me, I have that 600 yards. Everything's got to be perfect, and then I'll shoot under that. And once you go past that, I'm basically like, no, I need to get closer. So that's up to everyone to determine. The product itself, I took it the SIG BDX system. I took on my very first doll sheep hunt back in 2020, and frankly, I really liked it. Very nervous about the failure for the rangefinder to connect to the rifle scope. Just that that's obviously something that can happen. You're dealing with an electronic connection, you're out in the middle of nowhere. There are fail safes built into their system, so if that does happen, but if it does kind of happen in the heat of the moment, if you're not like practiced and ready to adjust for that, then that could be bad. But it was definitely as we were stocking animals, I'm sitting there like I'd range a rock and then make sure that I can't remember, like a little light would flash on the rifle scope, I believe, that would say it was connected. So you knew, okay, all right, it's good. But yeah, the use of it was fantastic. Like you didn't have to worry about anything. Range puts a little red dot exactly where you need to aim and you shot. And it was really cool. One of my favorite features was that it had inside the reticle on the extreme left and right of your windage bar was little arrows that told you if you were out of level or not. And I wish that was in other scopes just because it was so nice. You were just in the scope, especially on that. Like it was like a sheep hunt, it was very steep up and down, side hill stuff. And you're just in the scope, and little arrow says, can't this way or can't that way. And then everything would be green, if I remember right. When it was all lined up and you were good, you could set the sensitivity to like a half a degree or 1 degree, I believe. So you could say how sensitive you want it to be. And man, that was cool. So, definitely once for me, with all these newer rangefinders coming out that have everything built into them, so that I'm still running the SIG ELRange TAs, you're running the Revix.
Revic, yeah.
Yeah, they're, you've got your sensors for altitude and pressure in there, you've got temperature sensors, you've obviously got the range, and then it's going to tell you exactly what to dial on your scope. And that system is pretty fantastic, frankly. Like it's you got the rangefinder, which you're still limited to an electronic that could fail, but worst case, you just got your regular rifle scope, and you're zeroed out to 100. And obviously, as a backup, I've got my ballistic chart on my phone that through that ballistic app. And so if my rangefinder completely, fell off a cliff or something was gone and somebody else had one, then I could certainly get a range and then go look and dial, but dial based off of the ballistic chart and know, like, okay, at 400 yards, I've got, 9.5 inches of drop or whatever it is. Cool product. Now, again, I'm like, anything that's going to make you more accurate is just inherently going to be more ethical because you're going to consistently make cleaner kills. It's just within us to govern ourselves, to put a limiter on, like, okay, nope, that's too far. That's beyond my capability. And that's not an easy thing for people to do. It's not. We got It's natural to want to stretch and push the limits. It's natural to think you're more capable than you are. So you just have to do a really honest assessment of your capabilities. And I don't know any other way to do that but then just go practice, right? Like, I mean, if you're setting up a, you're relatively new to archery or you've been shooting for a while, but you're making some improvements, you need to go put a deer target in some very realistic terrain that you're going to be hunting and see what you're capable of and what's, say you're put that deer target at 70 yards. Do you need to hit it in the heart 10 out of 10 times? Is that like, I mean, you could also like, how accurate do you got to be? What was that article we just posted? Oh no, that's this week's, isn't it? Or did that go out last week's
It
email?
just went out last week.
Okay. Yeah. Where Kirchner's talking about ethics and not ethics, but wounding animals. And basically if you hunt long enough, it's going to happen. There's so many variables that are out of your control. You just do your best to rein those in and limit your kind of exposure to the potential for a bad shot. But eventually it's going to happen. So you immediately have to conclude that there is some margin for error, right? Just what is that? Is it, yeah. If you're okay, I can shoot any animal I want at 600 yards. So you go out to the mountains, you hang up some steel. Do you need to hit, 10 out of 10 shots on that? Is it 9 out of 10, 8 out of 10? That's again up to the person to make that decision.
Yeah, that article for people who didn't see it, we'll leave a link in that to the show description, and it's good in the sense that it doesn't answer every question, but it it almost raises more questions that I think all of us should proactively think through before we find ourselves in a situation. Because as you said, Steve, and as the article said, like, practice all you want, take shots you're fully confident in, like, do all those right things. But even when you do all that, you can still find yourself in the situation where potentially you've wounded an animal or you're questioning if a shot was fatal. And then this article kind of goes into, okay, well, now what? And I think it's, again, just worth proactively thinking through some of those things before you potentially find yourself in that situation in the future. So, yeah, I mean, to your point, like, and we're not, we're, this question is referencing the SIG BDX system, but two things you touched on there is really all ballistic rangefinders enable the same thing, meaning if you didn't have a ballistic rangefinder or call it a modern rangefinder period that wasn't as reliable, as accurate, didn't have the extended distances that they do now, like the fact that I'm carrying, say, the Revic BR4, or Steve, you have your EL ranges, you can still range something at, call it 900 yards, and get a holdover solution and dial your scope, right? So that same potential to push the boundaries and go, well, yeah, the rifle just says dial this, I can do it. That exists without the BDX system, just by having these newer rangefinders, period. And then really to go back in time and jump over to archery, the same dilemma exists on that end of, I mean, I remember starting with archery and shooting a fixed pin, multi-pin sight, right? But then going to my very first movable sight, a Black Gold Ascent, that created the same opportunity to push the boundary, to push beyond what I could previously do. So if I had a, my previous sight had pins for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, and 60 is a heck of a long shot. Well, now I can take that to 80 or 90 or 100, right? Because I now have a device that allows me to, in a perfect world, perfect conditions, perfect system, theoretically be accurate to new distances. So it's easy to pick on the new technology. It's easy to pick on like the SIG BDX, but yeah, go back 10 plus years ago and the same thing happened by moving to a slider sight on my bow over a decade ago. That same opportunity to push distance and to move from, as you said, Steve, something that is meant to make you more accurate, more capable, kill animals more quickly and effectively, now opens up the door to do the exact opposite, really. So there's a lot of personal boundaries that need to be set within technology.
That's it. You can just easily go high level. All these advancements are fantastic. They're making us more accurate, better shots. It's just instantly that happens. Then we're greedy. Like, oh, well, now I can shoot further. And that's a slippery slope. You could probably argue that the same amount of animals are getting wounded as a percentage of shots taken out there in the field, because guys were before laser rangefinders and archery, can you imagine the amount of terrible shots that were made because you thought it was 30 and it was 40 or whatever, and now the guys got rangefinders, they're all those 50 and under shots are a lot more accurate, but they get out there and they get beyond their capabilities and they start shooting. So maybe it's a wash, I don't know. Again, it just, to me, I'm all about anything that's going to increase my accuracy, and I just know that I'm able to put brakes on, through practice on what my capabilities are, and just hold to those once I get out there in the field.
So I'm really curious to hear what you say to this one. This gentleman wrote in and said, how do you, and he has in quotes here, toughen up your feet in the off season? He said, I drive a desk for my day job and I look forward to elk and deer season all year long. I tried to diet and work out for the mountains, but every year my weakest link is my feet. I've tried sock liners, Leukotape, moleskin, and even ordered a pair of custom insoles, all without success. I can wear my boots every day to work and can ruck on the weekends and for training, but he says, I'm still not getting the calluses I think I need to be successful in the backcountry in the fall. What do you guys suggest I can do to get over this hurdle? For example, I know that Cameron Haynes runs without socks. Is that something I need to try? And then he went on to say, attached are a few pics. And if you've already addressed this issue, please point me to that episode. He did attach a few pictures to his email, and his feet are absolutely tore up with terrible, like, yeah, half dollar size blisters and all kinds of issues. I saw this question, Steve, and I have a bunch of thoughts on it. I want to a little bit narrow down on the calluses and this idea of toughening up the feet because that's what he's addressing. I don't feel like I have good calluses on my feet or that they're particularly tough, but I also don't struggle with blisters like he does. And then you and I, Steve, were, I think, at the beginning of the death hike last week, and you mentioned something about calluses and like shaving them down. So I think you do have more calluses on your feet. I don't feel like I do. Yeah, where do you go from here, Steve?
Yeah, I do get them on like the inside of my big toe and then my heels. And what I've experienced, and that only shows up on showed up on the first 100 mile death hike, where the it's kind of the outside edge of my heel, there's a pretty good callus, man. I mean, they get like thick, certainly more than an eighth of an inch. And basically that thick skin isn't, is a dead skin. Then inside of that, there's the actual live skin and heel rubs against the callus. And I got a really big blister that's between the two, and they're hard to pop because it's all the way through that callus. So in fact,
Dang.
I could send you pictures of my heels right now
That's
from the
okay.
hike.
I'm good.
you don't need any more pictures.
No.
But yeah, you can see how thick the callus is. It's pretty interesting. So yeah, I took I went on Amazon and bought this little, I don't even know what the heck it'd be called, a callus remover. But it's a little handle on it, and then it's got a Y in between. It's an axle with like a basically sandpaper on it, and that just spins. And so yeah, I just before a hike generally take it and just remove all the calluses I can. And then
So,
I'll try to do that a couple weeks prior, and then obviously, you got like fresh new skin there that you beat up a little bit.
this guy's saying he thinks he needs calluses. Like, and
Yeah.
I
And
think
I'm
by
trying to
that he's
remove
just
them.
meaning he
Yeah.
needs his feet toughened up. And then you're
Definitely.
saying you're removing them or shaving them down. And I'm saying, I don't know what to say because I don't have any calluses, I don't think.
I know.
So,
I remember
yeah.
talking with Dave Kester, the guy we've had on the podcast before, if anyone remembers, up from Alaska and does a lot of mountain climbing, like big mountain ascents. And he actually would go to get a what the heck's that called? Foot
Pedicure.
pedicure. There you go. He would go get pedicures before a big event like that to remove all the calluses, at least shave them down to a point where they're not really, too big and substantial. So, to this guy's point, I mean, some of it kind of just sounds like some people just got bad feet that aren't meant for hiking, from what I've gathered. They just blister up no matter what, My initial reaction is, yeah, I mean, he needs to try some different boots. Maybe he'll have way better performance doing what I do and hunting the vast majority of the time out of like a light hiker slash running shoe that's more flexible. It's going to work with his feet better. He might sweat a lot, right? And so, and if he's not changing out his socks frequently, there's so many things you could go into here. And I do think there's I love to wear, like, I do have kind of hot sweaty feet, and I love just wearing flip-flops all summer long. And I do think that's akin to running and without socks on or something, to where you are kind of toughening up your feet. I think if you were wearing thick socks and boots all day long, that it's just it's kind of a lot of moisture in there, right? Which would tend to have you'd kind of have to have soft feet after a while. I don't know. I'm just spitballing here.
Yeah, I mean, I think one is that in this guy, like if I was him, I would just be looking for help, right? Which is what he's doing. That's why he reached out. But meaning locally, like I don't know whether that's a podiatrist, whether that's a non-hunting outdoor store, right? Like going to an REI, going to something where it's like, people who have experience, doesn't need to be hunting related or specific to hunting boots, of like, yeah, look at my feet. Is there something crazy here? Like, am I nuts? Am I doing something wrong? Or do I have a unique need or issue because of the structure of my foot? That's where I would be going first. And then to your point, Steve, I had the same thought. If this guy's only tried, call it normal slash traditional, by that I just mean,
Garbage hunting boots.
yeah, garbage like hunting boots. Like if you've only tried full leather stuff, stiff stuff, again, those work great for some people, but clearly if that's all you've tried and maybe you've tried different pairs, so you're like, oh, well, I've tried Crispy and I've tried Kenitrek and I've tried with this, but if they've all been a similar type of hunting boot, maybe that's your problem, right? So I had the same thought of maybe this guy's just like, because he's wearing stiff boots and maybe has unique feet, he's not getting something that works with his foot. It doesn't have flex, it doesn't have give, and it's just creating a bunch of issues. So get, if all he's tried is things in the hunting boot category, get outside of that. Try something else.
I've been lining out the for the experience project, like one obviously one or multiple episodes will be on boots, and I just like the general consensus is if your feet aren't happy, keep trying. So that, I mean, this guy's obviously trying to do that, but I do think so many guys would be way like I was some video popped up and somebody's like, well, if you're going on a mountain hunt, you need these, you know, and they're basically just bricks that you strap to the bottom of your feet. And I'm like, that's freaking terrible advice. Like, you need to keep, you can do any hunt anywhere with in a freaking Nike shoe. Just depends on the person and what your body likes. And certainly like through the death hikes, we've learned some guys need a boot, you know, and I think a lot of it is because that's what they're used to wearing, and they've never built up the muscles and trained their ankles and stuff to operate with something that's not so supportive. But I think it's kind of a backwards, I think you need to start that process, and maybe it takes multiple years. But if you're relying on a really stiff, heavy boot that doesn't allow your body to move, because you just change your gait. Your foot doesn't move. You don't get the natural kind of lift of your heel. In general, I think a really stiff boot is maybe right for 5 out of 100 guys. That the vast majority of people would prefer a lighter, more flexible, more dynamic boot shoe that's on their feet. So
Yeah,
maybe that's where this guy's at is he's got some really stiff boots and he's tried a few of them, but that's because somebody told him you need a stiff boot for hunting, right? Like just bad advice, and that's ingrained into what he needs to buy, and that's what he's looking for when he goes to Cabela's or wherever to select boots. And so yeah, just go flip that around, man. Go buy a real light, flexible shoe and start training with that and see if you have better feet.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean, like. Be fun to talk to this guy on the phone, maybe, and
Yeah.
go through more of his experiences. But
Yeah, for sure. And just to illustrate his point, I mean, he says it in here. He says, he looks forward to elk and deer season all year long. He's dieting, he's working out, he's doing everything he can, but then his feet are the weakest link. And that's an unfortunate reality. I mean, if you can do everything to be ready, but at the end of the day, if you're hunting in the backcountry and you're trying to put on miles and search for game and you have severe issues with your feet, like that can stop you in your tracks. So it as frustrating as it can be to try and figure this out and find what works for you, it's also one of the most important things you can do. I mean, we've said it so many times over the years, like boots and pack, those are the two things that at the end of the day, you have to figure out what's going to work and enable you to hunt effectively. Because if those two go wrong, and we're not saying this to sell packs, but like if those two things, either one of them, or God forbid, both of them go wrong, like you are truly limiting your capabilities in the backcountry.
yeah, foot. I mean, footwear is by far number one. Like, it's this guy's covered in blisters on day three of a hunt for, and he's still got, 5, 6 more days to go. You're done. Like, you can only be so tough with when your feet are messed up.
All right, guys. Well, if you have any follow-ups, if you have any questions for a future episode, send those to us. You can email podcast@exomountaingear.com. You can also look for the link in the show description to leave us an audio message, and we can answer that on a future episode. We have several other links we'll include, things we mentioned previously already from this episode, the bear skinning video, the article, signing up for the newsletter. And then just make sure you're subscribed to receive future updates and future podcasts, including a bunch of death hike content that's coming here real soon. As always, thank you for tuning in and also sharing the questions and feedback. We certainly appreciate it, and we'll talk to you soon.